You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Lori R. King is the author of so many books it would take far too long for me to tell you about, but I will tell you that some 30-plus years ago, I was browsing in a bookstore near where I live in the Aptos Bookworks, no longer with us, God rest, and I found a book that I thought would be absolutely perfect for me. I'm a longtime Sherlock Holmes fan. When I was a kid, I rode from Covina into Los Angeles just to buy all of Sherlock Holmes' adventures, and I found a book in Aptos that was called Beekeeper's Apprentice, and it was a Sherlock Holmes mystery told through the device of another character, Mary Russell. Yes, oh, she's frowning. We'll talk to her about that. And on the front cover, there was a little sticker that said, local author. And I said, really? That was great. Here we are. It's 2025. The world is going to hell in a handbasket. But let me tell
readers. And I'm still writing about Mary Russell. I haven't learned a lesson yet.
Let me tell our listeners that the latest Mary Russell novel, Knave of Diamonds, is an absolute delight. It is so much fun to read. You won't want it to end, and I certainly didn't. Thank you for joining me, Lori.
Thank you, Rick. I always love talking to you.
Let's plunge right in. How far into this series are you? How many books?
This is 19, and there's a volume of short stories.
So we're 19 books in. That's a long ways. A lot has gone on. Well, much water has gone under that bridge. It's gone up and down, if it's London Bridge, many times. One of the things I really admired about this book was that the way you introduced it and brought us right into the midst of a lot of story that's going on in the recent books and also caught us up. Talk about writing the next, quote, novel in a series and setting up your readers so that somebody like me, whose brain is more sieve-like every year, can pick up that book and say, oh my God, this is great. There's no professor saying, well, now, here's what has happened in the past. But it's natural. It's page turning to find out. So talk about setting up the next book in the series.
Thank you, Rick. It's always something that you have to sort of fiddle with, because I'm one of those writers who doesn't usually use any kind of outline or plan. I have a vague idea where it's going, and I kind of know. I sometimes will make notes of if I have a timeline sequence I sort of need to keep in mind as I'm doing various scenes. But for the most part, I'm exploring the story, telling myself the story, because I don't know how people write to an outline, because once you tell the outline, who bothers writing the book, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But so my first draft is always, for me, it's telling myself the story. And I then have to go back and make sure that it makes sense for actual other people. And one of those things that you do there is to say, what's the bare minimum that someone needs to know to follow the book along? And I think people who, especially people who read mysteries, are well accustomed to just dropping into things and going with it. You don't need much explanation. You need to sort of know when and where and that kind of thing. But I mean, if you just open a book with the sense that the reader will be willing to suspend disbelief, so long as you give them enough clues along the way as to what the territory looks like, most of them will be fine. And so You start out with a character that I wrote this character some years ago when I was doing a short story. And it's the short story was called Mary's Christmas. That is from Mary Russell's past when she has this rascally uncle who comes to stay, and her mother adores him, and her father is very dubious about the whole thing. But Uncle Jake is just this charming con man. He's a con man. And they have an adventure, and that's when she's maybe 10 years old. And then he disappears. She mentions thinking about him once or twice in, but with 19 books after that, you sort of he doesn't he's never seen. So for most people who are reading this, it doesn't matter that this character is unknown, because it's just so long as you say in the beginning that she had this uncle she loved. Life has changed a lot. Too bad he's probably dead because he got into some trouble that he couldn't get out of. And isn't that sad? Except, as a mystery reader, you know that anyone who says, oh, yes, he's probably gone, the author is not going to stop there and just go off and tell a different unrelated story, right? So, of course, Uncle Jake shows up at her door. And you quickly build this idea of who Russell and Holmes are, the fact that they start out in, it's immediately following the last one. So it starts out from Jake's point of view, but the very first chapter after that is Mary's point of view. And it's at the thing that they had gone to France to celebrate a wedding in the last book, which was called The Lantern's Dance. And so it using that chapter where it sort of put an end to the previous adventure enabled me to have her to mention her Uncle Jake, because of course it's all about family and she thinks about people that she's lost, including Uncle Jake. And so, oh yes, it's very sad, and let's go home and we'll get back to life. And then of course, surprise! Jake's at the door. And even more to the point, Mary Russell's partner and husband, a character named Sherlock Holmes, is not home. And this is a deliberate choice on Jake's part, because he's going to drag Russell into something. And so that's where I started with it, of this charming rogue, a knave, who drags Russell kicking and screaming into something that she really doesn't want to get into.
I was thinking of what causes us to turn the pages in a mystery, and a lot of that's, what's going to happen, who's going to get hurt, is it going to get found, what's going on, who did what, and there is that in triple spades in this book. But I think more than that, what caused me to turn the pages was a word you mentioned, charm. Jake is such a charming person, and on the page, he's a delight to read. And the contrast and similarity between Jake and Mary is just also extremely charming and delightful. And the contrast between the two of them and Sherlock Holmes, who's rendered in a third person, is also a delight. So you create this tension just by the perception of the three characters. Talk about working charm and using charm to turn the pages.
Yeah, it's funny because that word is often used in the Russell books to indicate that she doesn't trust anyone further than she could throw them. Charm is one of those really dangerous gifts that if you have too much charm, you can get away with way, way too much. And so I think people who know me as a writer, know that that's a little signal that don't think he's just Mr. Nice Guy. So, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting to build a new character, which Jake basically was, because you only saw him in this short story a long time ago. To have, when you're starting out with writing a new character, you have to try and choose their voice, because obviously that was his, I wanted him to have his own chapters in the book. And I decided that I would put him in first person rather than Sherlock Holmes's chapters are always third person, so you can follow him. And Russell is the first person. She's narrating the books. But I thought it would be much more interesting to put Jake as a first person too. And in fact, I was playing with these ideas, and I came across, for some reason I had not come across them before, Martha Wells's Murderbot books. Do you know them?
I know of them, but I have not read them. They've just been turned into a Netflix TV series. Netflix or Apple?
They are.
Apple.
They are. Yeah, I think. The books themselves are much more interesting. The program itself is fine, but mm-hmm. The books themselves are much more interesting because the character is snarky.
Mm.
His voice, that he's a robot that manages to to hack his governor module so he doesn't have to obey people, but he does because he can't think of anything better to do. So, but he just snarks all the time, and I thought this is such a delicious voice that it sort of encouraged me to build Jake around that, those sort of comments. So he often reflects on what's going on with these little parenthetical remarks of, oh my God, sort of rolling his eyeballs.
I love you. You mean that literally parenthetical?
Yeah. Which it'll be interesting to see how the guy reads it in the audiobooks. Because in the audiobooks, they have three readers for the audiobooks, which is a good choice, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I like this. I like the voice they chose for the American one, Jake. But it'll be interesting to see how they do that, because they are very parenthetical, and without the signs of the brackets, it's going to be require pacing. But I loved the idea of building a character that you trust him, because Russell basically trusts him. But you know he's got an agenda, and you know it's going to be a problem at some point. The only question is, how big a problem is it going to be? And is it just going to be against Holmes, which we probably could live with, or is he going to betray Russell, which really would be hard? So, you know, this is something that I play with throughout the book, of so that he's sort of very apparently transparent and open with Russell, but you don't trust him far. And he's transparent in a very different way, a very sort of manly, men of the world kind of way with Holmes when the two of them have interactions. So it's it was a challenge as a writer to build a character who had many faces and yet be leaving the reader convinced that he had other faces that you weren't seeing still.
You know, there was so much, I thought, writerly skill on display in this book, and it was so, so skilled in its execution that one really tended not to notice, because, to be honest, I just had a blast reading this book. And it was really fun. I just look forward to sitting down and getting immersed in these go back and forth between Jake and Russell and Holmes. So talk about, did you have fun?
Oh, yeah. I think you can always tell when a writer's having fun with a book, mm-hmm. can't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's made, that's because it's fun to read.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the trio of characters themselves enabled me to do things with the other two each time. When I was focusing on one, I could tell you things about the other two that you may not have known from talking to them.
And that is where the writerly skills come in. Now, this book is based on a very famous and very well-known incident, and I didn't know how complicated the incident was. It's extremely complicated. And I thought afterwards, my God, how did she write this? Because it was like, you know, snakes and ladders. Oh, this character has to go this way. You are balancing the real world, Mary Russell's world, Arthur Conan Doyle's world, and Sherlock Holmes's world. And Doyle shows up.
Yeah. In fact, I've just finished writing an essay for the blog Crime Reads, where I talk about, you know, building a story around actual facts. And it's tricky because I am an academic by training and by inclination, that I don't like to not use firm facts. And when I have to change something, it's really painful because I like to be able to tell the truth. I mean, I lie, obviously. What we do. But I wanted to use as many of the sheer facts of event and person and date as I possibly could. Which, of course, makes it tricky because, as you say, you're working these other two worlds in and around it. So I had to sort of figure a way that there's this 1907 crime that obviously Mary Russell was too young. She was only 7 years old then, but Holmes was not too young. And so to bring in what he was doing, according to Conan Doyle, and what what Russell was doing and what Jake could have been doing and what was going on with these various characters. Because there's three major true life characters in the book. I mean, there's a number of other ones, smaller ones, but that I had to make sure that their dates worked. And there was only one that I had to change, that the Scotland Yard investigator of the case, I believe, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell with online research, and unless you're going walking around, cemeteries in London, it's a little difficult to be sure, but I think that the investigator had died before the story picks up again. So he died before 1925. But I thought, honestly, I need to have him. And I think that it's only right that he should have word in this. So I did, but I always put notes in my afterword when I do that kind of thing so that people know I got it right. I always like it when people who actually know something tell me, I wasn't sure you'd get it right, but you did. I think, yay me. So yeah, but it's, you know, it's this sort of, the sensation is kind of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle that doesn't have a picture to it. You're having to kind of fit the various pieces together and make a shape and fit them, and you think, so, but that's hopefully I.
Amazing job. It was just amazing because, you know, I was partway through, most of the way through the book, and then I looked up the inciting incident, as it were, in Wikipedia, and found at the very, very end of the Wikipedia article a mention of this book, the book I was reading.
That's
fast. Well, that's why we love Wikipedia. And as I read through the article, I thought, oh my God, she got all this stuff. It just, this is like, you know, it's like a pachinko machine or something where the ball had to go through this shooting, that shooting, this shooting, that shooting. And I just thought, wow, that must have been incredible. But I guess you made this all up as you went. How much research did you do, like, in advance to prepare your brain for this?
Well, obviously, if you're trying to work around a real-life crime, you have to be fairly well-versed in the crime. And there's two or three books on the topic which disagree with each other violently, which is fine because I can see in the two that have different opinions, once you've started going into the actual source material, you can see where they're getting things and where they're interpreting rather than telling. And so I figured, you know, any interpreting I could put in kind of gray ink in my notes, as it were. Whereas the others had to be firm. They were there. So, you know, one of the more interesting things about this case as a real life case is that it was unsolved. And so you have this enormous theft right out from under the noses of the most secure offices in Dublin. At a time that, you know, created the maximum amount of turmoil, confusion, and animosity just before the king was about to wear these jewels for an investiture. And yet, the viceregal commission that was brought together to investigate, reading carefully in the actual report, you can see their hands are tied from the beginning, that whoever set it up didn't want to know a lot of things, which was great for me. I mean, not so great for the people who, you know, actually could have used those diamonds and such. But for me, it was great because I could then play with the idea of, well, if there was something going on behind the scenes and it had to have been an inside job because the only man who had keys to this safe was the guy whose office it was. But to try and figure out how it would be possible to not only get them away, but to get away with it, was the fun part. And some of it is obvious, that everyone assumes that the reason that it wasn't, and without giving spoilers here, that the reason it wasn't going to be solved in the correct manner is that it would reveal things that nobody wanted revealed. But beyond that, I needed my characters to solve the case, right? I mean, because it's not a mystery novel if you say, I don't know. You know, no, nobody wants to spend $30 on a novel and have it say, I don't know. You have to have something that is logical, that is believable from all the stuff that you know up to the point that Laurie enters into the narrative, and yet gives me, you know, the chance to write a fun story, because I didn't want to write a dark story about reputations ruined. And there's enough dark stuff in it. I mean, the guy whose office lost the jewels, he was a pompous little man, but he didn't deserve to be taken out and shot by the IRA. I mean, it's a dark enough fate for anyone. But, you know, so that I didn't want to get into the possibilities that could have sucked that particular case into the unsolved category. I wanted it to be fun because, you know, 2024 wasn't fun. And I figured 2025 was not going to be fun. And I like, these are entertainments. And I like my entertainments to have elements of thoughtfulness and leaving people with ideas, but I don't like people to come away from one of my books thinking, "Oh God, the world's a terrible place."
No, as a matter of fact, I thought the book was shockingly positive, given the ample opportunity for being a kind of a downer. You mentioned Ireland. Have you traveled there extensively?
Yeah, I've been there, not extensively, but I've been there a couple of times. My husband had family there, so we went a couple of times. So,
It's a beautiful place. It's so lovely. We were in Dublin and then took a day trip out to some seaside place that was just amazingly gorgeous. Walked
yeah,
on
it
the
is.
cliffs. And I think that's one of the things you do. So talk about using the terrain of Ireland as a setting for the mystery. Just, they brain soaked. I mean, not unfamiliar to those of us who live in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, it's a different world, and especially in the 20s. I mean, in the 20s could easily have been, early 19th century in a lot of the more rural areas. Very few automobiles, very few, nobody had refrigerators or telephones. It was a rural economy, and especially because the potato famine was only, what, 75 years before, and had just ripped out the center of the population and sent it off to America. And that's why so many of us are Irish and English, is that, the potato famine just reduced the country to starvation. And I think that in the 20s, they're just starting to recover, and getting back underway. But of course, the 20s is also when the IRA is starting up and the nationalist movement is starting up. And, Britain is trying to hold on to things without having to draw a tight line between the two Irelands.
Easier said than done. One of the things I think that you handle really well is an aspect of the rings that you refer to in the book, of the sexuality of the homosexuals, as they called them back then. I thought you did just a marvelous job of showing us a time when that was forbidden without making us feel like it should be forbidden or that there was any judgment. Just that is the way it was. And I thought that was, handled really deftly. And so thank you for that absolutely lovely portrait of an unlovely aspect of our civilization.
Yeah, I mean it's tricky to write about because on the one hand it was, especially in England, it was accepted that, especially men, a lot of men were just this way, and nobody paid much attention unless there was a scandal. I mean, it was the saying that, just don't frighten the horses. On the other hand, it could turn into a scandal because it was, if you were gay, you had to stay hidden to some extent. And that opened people up to blackmail and to living lives that were open to manipulation. So when there had been two huge homosexual scandals in Europe in the recent past, when the theft took place in 1907, one that just sort of toppled the German government. And of course, Germany and England, until World War I, Germany and England were basically the same family. So, they're all related. So, but there had been this huge scandal that shook the German government just not that long before. So the English king was extremely aware of it. And there had been a similar one that took place actually in Ireland in, I think it was 1880. Anyway, in again in recent past, that shook governments. And they didn't, with the fragile state of affairs between Ireland and England at the time, they didn't want to risk another shakeup of the entire upper echelon of the Irish government. So it wasn't until a year after this, after the theft, when everyone was just mo had moved on, that an American journal, an Irish journal, Irish American journal, had a front page story about the atrocities, they called it, the atrocities in Dublin Castle, which were these quite innocuous sherry parties with Arthur Vickers and his buddies. Oh, we're probably gay. I mean, I think in the book, one of the characters says that he doesn't even think Arthur Vickers was actually gay. I think he was just sort of asexual because he was just, his passion was genealogy. And you kind of think, it's not really a very passionate sort of life for somebody to lead is old books and registers, but it's okay. To everyone their thing. But the scandal came a year later when this thing was published, which actually worked really well for me as a writer, because one of the key dates in the Jake story is a year after this thing takes place. And so I thought, aha, I can use this. So
Speaking of Jake, I was partway through the book and I start when I started to think she's gonna bring him back. He might get his own series. Is that the case, or do you?
He is fun, isn't he? Yeah, you kind of think he's got to show up at some point again because he really is just too fun to leave aside. But I think he's a typical character that you learn about as you go along, isn't he? I mean, you were saying that the homosexual lifestyle in England was perceived as one way. But I think that then as now, there's a lot of people who live their lives, and that's who they are. And it's you, I mean, certainly in the first Jake story, he was not identifiably gay because it didn't matter to the story. All it is he's a single man who's not married, and that's all you need to know about him for that story. For this story, there are various mentions, but it never really enters into the center of the thing. Although, in fact, it's one of the reasons why he's there in 1907. It's because he's gay.
Also, too, there are a couple of other characters in this book who are just so thoroughly enjoyable. I really want to see them again. And one of them is a fellow based on a real character, the O'Mahony. I mean, this guy's got to have his own broadcast TV show.
Isn't he fabulous?
It seems like, did you have, that look, that seemed like a pretty accurate rendition of him.
It's one of those characters that you just can't make up, Rick. I just you think, okay, you can have this one. I don't know where to start. The O'Mahony was raised as an upper class English gentleman, the schooling and the rest of it. But he went back to where the family fortunes, which he, as the eldest son, inherited, went back to Dublin. Arthur Vickers himself spent a lot of his youth in Ireland, and so he thought of himself as Irish rather than English, though he was half. So, but I found the character of the older brother. He just, as one of the characters in the book says, he's eccentric as a bent bicycle wheel. He inherits a fortune when he's very young, and he regards it as a title, being the head of the clan, but it's not really a title to it. Manages to convince the Russian, the Tsarist government that he should inherit another family fortune. And then when traveling through Europe, discovers the cause of Bulgarian orphans. So he spends vast sums of money on this huge Bulgarian orphanage. And so he becomes a sort of patron saint of Bulgaria for his orphans. His passion in life, other than Bulgarian orphans, is gardening, landscaping. And so he has a number of estates that he sort of transforms and, has found all these plants from overseas and the rest of it. And he starts getting more and more nationalist so that he takes on the clan title of chieftain and regards himself as the O'Mahony and adds O, which had been dropped at some point. And starts wearing kilts, is one of the people who tries to save the breed of the Irish wolfhound, and has a bagpiper on the premises that walks around with him when he's going for walk around just gardens in the evening. I mean, I thought I need this character in the book.
Well, he's a natural because of the Irish wolfhounds and Holmes's experience in the past. I mean, I just, it was really, again, a delight to read. There's also a woman character. You have
Mrs. Walsh.
Mrs. Walsh. Again, you're just having too much fun with this character. Writing her dialogue or monologue is better. So talk about creating Mrs. Walsh.
Well, it's one of those things where you have one character like the O'Mahony, who is just so extreme that you have to have somebody equally extreme to balance him, because otherwise there's it's like having the Matterhorn plunked down in the middle of a cornfield. I thought, oh, whatever he is, she's even more so. So I had to bring her in, and she's related to the Irish background of the whole thing, because she is works for Vickers's widow. So that's the excuse that she used just to get in there. But I mean, talk about eccentric. She's eccentric. I think that there's a number of things that are going on in there, most of which are in the back of my head and will take a number of years to work themselves out. So, without doing too many spoilers here, I think that Mrs. Walsh is going to be a character that we see more of.
Yeah, and I hope the O'Mahony is around to balance her. He is just a hoot and a holler. What's the state of the estate, as it were, in terms of the Sherlock Holmes stories? Where are
Oh,
they in terms of public domain?
they are in the public domain. Yeah, when I first started, a lot of the stories were still under copyright. And a number of years ago, my friend Les Klinger and I were doing one in our series of anthologies where we would invite crime writing friends to be inspired by the Sherlock Holmes canon. The story, there's five different books, but 30. Anyway, quite a few authors had got involved with it by the end. And they all would write things that were different. And it was amazing. There were one or two actual Holmesian pastiches in there. But for the most part, they would just take something and run with it. And they were such fun. And at some point, I think it may have been Michael Sims, I'm not sure, had proposed to write a character that was still among those few that were under copyright, because copyright is, 75 years and then it's public domain. And the Conan Doyle estate got wind of it and said, you can't do that without paying us. And we said, no, I don't think so. And so they anyway, court cases involved. And one of the advantages of our situation was that Les is a longtime Sherlockian and a lawyer. So he knows copyright lawyers all over. So he had people that we could ask, how do we do this? We sued basically saying, no, this character is in the public domain. They retorted by saying, but all these stories that define his character, the last few stories, they define and they're key to the whole thing. And those are still under copyright. So therefore, you can't use any of the situations that led up to that. And we said, no, he's well established before those stories. And the well established part is what we're using. So it went actually to the Supreme Court. And if anyone is interested, we've left up the website that's called Free Sherlock. And it has, among other things, a very interesting Court of Appeals report from Judge Posner about the case and what is copyright, what's the purpose of it, and why is this not under copyright. And basically, he agreed that it was just a sort of extortion. And so when a few years after this judgment, the estate tried to stop the Enola Holmes things from being broadcast on Netflix, Les stuck his hand up and said, you might want to take a look at this. Because it's their public domain. And you can't trademark a character like that. You can't extend a copyright beyond what is in existence. And so, no, it's in the public domain.
It seems just that a case with Mr. Holmes would end up in the Supreme Court of the United States, does it not? Now, you have several other series kind of juggling that you've been juggling throughout. And so are you going directly into another Mary Russell book? Or are you going to play back? I love the last book that we talked about. I love that new character. So I would like to see more of her.
Yeah, Raquel Lang.
Yeah.
Back to the Garden was a couple of years ago. We published a couple of years ago. And because it's kind of hard to build momentum from a publishing sales point of view, they asked me if I would, instead of just alternating, to do two of the Russells and then go back to Raquel. So the one that I'm working on now is another Raquel Lang. Doesn't have a title yet. It's set in San Francisco. There will be a cold case element to it. Raquel Lang is a sort of Sherlock Holmes in that she's obviously neurodivergent. In her case, she has training in things like micro expressions and body language. But I try not to get too bogged down in either the training or indeed her diagnosis, because I think that for a lot of people, it's just the way they are. I mean, you can diagnose Sherlock Holmes in various ways, and people have, and people will continue to, and that's fine. But I'm not sure it really tells you an awful lot more about who he is as a person. And to some extent, I'm kind of keeping to that approach with Raquel Lang. She is her own person. She is what she is. But in the first one, one of the side effects of that approach was that I said almost nothing about her outside of the case she was working on, which was a cold case set in 1970s in and modern time. So, but you know very little about her as a person at the end of the book, which was both a problem and a deliberate choice, because I wanted her to be this enigmatic character. This, on the other hand, is all about her. It's her past, her parentage, her adoptive family, her, you know, it's all her. So it'll be sort of the complete opposite. And she's working on a case that involves her and her sister. And there's elements in it. Again, I'm trying not to make it dark because there are dark elements in it, but we will see where that goes. So, but yeah, that'll be, I think they have it penciled in as September 2026. I have to finish writing it first.
Going back to Knave of Diamonds, the conclusion to this was just really, I thought, excellent. And I thought you did a fabulous 100% knocked it out of the ballpark job of solving the case and dealing with all those people, you know, a fairly large crowd of people who are caught up in it. So talk about that decision that you and Mr. Holmes make, just in terms of, you know, writing that so that it would provide the satisfying conclusion to a thrilling mystery.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of it's one of those stories that's fun because there's two conclusions. There's one, the case that they're actually working on, and then there's the conclusion of the social aspect of what's going on. And I found that, I mean, it's difficult with finding the solution to the case that didn't involve either doing violence to actual real life, because again, no spoilers here, because some of the characters involved do go on, and you'd have to do is look them up on the Googles and find that, well, Laurie lied to me here. So you have to have some kind of balance between justice and reality, that I had wanted to play with and to bring in all the characters and give them each their role. Because as you say, I mean, some of the characters are great fun, and you kind of think, yeah, we need to make this guy more important.
Well, I thought that one thing I must say is that this novel really demonstrates a great expertise in terms of satisfying storytelling all the way through. At the beginning, we're given, you know, a new character and a whole new mystery, and throughout it, we love reading about the new character and the old characters and the way they all interact, and you know, the crime itself is really enjoyable and complicated, and to wrap it up, you know, in that way. So talk about, you know, your work as a storyteller. Was that the result of planning, improvisation or some kind of unconscious collaboration with yourself between the two parts of you, the storyteller, improvising storyteller, and the person who knows, wants, you know, that satisfying written narrative?
Yeah, because, I mean, a story like this, and especially, I think all the Russell series are, they're kind of presented as being her memoirs. So they're all a story about her rather than a story about crime fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in most of them, probably, the crime is only of concern to a reader, because it's part of what is going on in her life. You know what? The last one, for example, The Lantern's Dance, there is a crime in there, but it's learning about Sherlock Holmes's history is much more important to the reader and to the people involved than actual solving of any particular crime. And I think that that's always a balance, because you don't want a mystery story that doesn't have any crime in it. Even the more cozy mysteries have a nice convenient dead body somewhere, and then you could ignore it and get on with the cups of tea and dog conversations. But so it is a balance. You have to have something that satisfies the person who reads mysteries because of the intellectual exercise. You know, the idea of a mystery, rather, a thriller is all about emotion. You know, will they save the world? Will they get there in time? The mystery is intellectual. It's figuring it out, preferably before the detective gets there, but you have to play fair. And the stuff I do is sort of in between. It's more detective element than thriller. It's kind of in the suspense realm, which is the middle of it. And so you want something that is clear and predictable and a satisfying explanation to the problem, especially when it's a real life problem. But you also want something that is emotionally satisfying to the characters involved and to the reader. You don't want to have a great character like Uncle Jake and kill him off. It's just, yeah, I don't know. And you want, I deliberately made that secondary ending of the Mrs. Walsh theme. I deliberately put that last because that's the note that I wanted to end the thing on, was, you know, this is such a weird family. Where is it going next?
The new novel by the Queen of Mystery, Laurie R. King, is The Knave of Diamonds. Thank you for joining me, Laurie.
Thank you, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.